ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
As the war in Ukraine approaches its 16th month, the question of what Russian President Vladimir Putin might do next is as acute as ever. My next guest suggests that maybe the answer can be found in Putin's distant past, when he was a student reading Cold War thrillers, watching Russian spy movies, and dreaming of joining the KGB. That's one of the theories found in Mark Hollingsworth's new book, Agents of Influence: How the KGB Subverted Western Democracies. It's a work which delves into Russia's long history of espionage and disinformation, exploring how the Soviet spy agency used covert operations to destabilise the UK, the US and NATO countries during the Cold War. But it also brings us right up to the present day, drawing parallels between KGB Cold War operations and disinformation campaigns waged by bots and trolls following the invasion of Ukraine. Mark Hollingsworth is an investigative journalist and author of 10 books, including Londongrad, From Russia with Cash, The Inside Story of the Oligarchs. And he also writes regularly for The Times, The Spectator and The Guardian. I'm delighted he's joining us now from London. Mark, welcome to Late Night Live.
Pleasure to be with you.
First of all, Mark, can you give us a quick KGB primer, if there is indeed such a thing? Where did the KGB come from and how did it morph into its modern day successor, the FSB?
Well, originally, historically, the KGB was born out of the 1917 Russian Revolution, when Lenin decided that he needed a secret police to ensure that the new Soviet communist regime would be preserved and secured. So he set up a secret police called the Cheka, which was incredibly brutal and authoritarian, which was basically set up to spy on what they called counter-revolutionaries, the White Russians who opposed the communist revolution in 1917. And that was his first secret police, which lasted into the 1920s and was used basically as an agency of repression. But as time moved on into the 1930s, when Stalin took over, and particularly in the early days of the Cold War, the Cheka and then different Russian intelligence agencies went through different names, but they became much more an agency about spying on the West, spreading disinformation, recruiting agents in Western countries in the United States. So by the time the Cold War started in the late 1940s, it was more of an agency about covert operations and espionage in the West. And the actual KGB was not actually constituted until 1954. But before then, it had different agency names. But by 1954, when the KGB was launched, it had become a crucial agency in the Cold War in terms of trying to destabilize the West, Western Europe, and the United States by disinformation, forgery of documents, honey trapping, recruiting of agents, and basically trying to destabilize the West.
When Boris Yeltsin came to power, he ultimately broke up the KGB because it was too big, too much of a threat. Is that when the FSB was formed from the ashes of the KGB?
Well, when Boris Yeltsin became president of Russia in 1991, he regarded the KGB as having too much power because it was like a state within a state. It answered really only to itself. It had no accountability. It only answered to the Communist Party during the Cold War. So he felt he needed to consolidate political power on the basis of him being elected in Russia in the early 90s, and that there needed to be some kind of parliamentary democratic institution where, and that the KGB needs to be reined back. So it was officially abolished and reconstituted as the FSB. And so it definitely lost a lot of its power. But the reality is that Russia in the 1990s still had a secret service. It still had an intelligence agency. It was called the FSB. and they still operated in the same way. They just didn't have as much power as the KGB did during the Cold War and as later the FSB did under Putin. So the 1990s, they weren't abolished. I would argue they were just restructured, refocused.
In your book, you actually argue that the history of the Russian secret police can be traced all the way back to Ivan the Terrible and Peter the Great in, well, the 1500s and 1600s. That's quite a claim. Is that the existence of an agency within the state?
Yes, I think that if you look at the history of Russia, it's a history of authoritarianism and poverty and being invaded by Napoleon and then Hitler in the Second World War. And it's a history of insecurity. It's a huge country with amazing natural resources, but it's also a country that has been governed by dictators. And you can go that, as you say, you go back to Ivan the Terrible and Peter the Great, and Catherine the Great. So for them, the use of a secret police or a security service, even going back to the 16th century, was very important to stabilize the country and to make sure that there was no opposition and no dissidents. And that really has manifested itself. Really, the whole history of Russia has been that way, and they regard the West as decadent. And today, as you can see from the evidence, is that Russia's become even more authoritarian in terms of the suppression of free speech and opposition. But it was certainly, you can trace it back historically.
Well, coming back to the modern era of the KGB and then the FSB, Vladimir Putin once famously said, quote, "There's no such thing as a former KGB man." And he was talking about someone else at the time, but Putin was a KGB officer himself from 1975 to 1991, a fairly low-ranking one, as you and others have noted. But how formative do you think that early stage of his career was?
I think Putin's formative career in the KGB in the 70s and 80s was incredibly influential and formative, as you say, in that when the Cold War ended in late 1989, Putin was a KGB officer in Dresden in East Germany, and he could see firsthand the end of the Warsaw Pact, the end of the Soviet Union, and that was for him very humiliating. In his own book, in his own words, he relates how he telephoned Moscow when there were literally protesters outside the KGB office where he was and asking for help, and Moscow was silent. And for him, he's been quite open about this, the decline of the Soviet Union, the old Soviet Empire, was humiliating and a disaster for Putin. And so I think there's enough evidence to show that really ever since, I would say certainly from 2007 onwards, he's been planning to try and restore some version of the Soviet Union politically, and certainly planning to invade Ukraine since 2014. And so that is always in his mind. I mean, if you look at his philosophy politically, I mean, it's very much based on Russian Orthodox philosophy and Soviet communist view of the world, which is have to have a very strong state. He actually does accept that you need to work in a capitalist free market economy. But he also believes that the state has to play a really extraordinary strategic role in the economy, in terms of this still, obviously the state plays a major role in the Russian economy. So I think Putin's career in the KGB is really important to examine, because it does tell you a lot about why he's in Ukraine and what he's doing now.
Well, let's go from his KGB career to his ascendancy to power. You start your book with Putin's involvement in the smearing of Russia's former prosecutor general, Yuri Skuratov. And you say everything in that case had all the hallmarks of, you know, a classic KGB play. Can you tell us the story?
Well, when Yeltsin was president in the last sort of years of his presidency, 1999, obviously the issue was who was going to succeed him. And Putin at the time was prime minister, And he had been head of the, well, I think he was actually head of the FSB at the time. And there was a prosecutor in the Russian law enforcement agency called Skuratov, and he was investigating corruption in the Yeltsin inner circle. And the 1990s was riddled with corruption in terms of the oligarchs ripping off the Russian state and acquiring huge assets, but also inner the circle of Yeltsin were also corrupt. And so this corruption investigation was irritating Yeltsin. And so Putin basically decided that to ingratiate himself with Yeltsin, they should do a honey trap operation against the prosecutor, against the guy who was investigating the Yeltsin corruption. And so they hired these girls, almost certainly prostitutes or women who they could pay, to honey trap this guy Skuratov. And they did it in that classic KGB way. As I'm sure you know, the vanity of middle-aged men is infinite. And so the guy fell for it. And they filmed them in a bedroom together. And then they had the video. And so they then leaked the video to a Russian TV station. And that was broadcast to basically to smear and get rid of this prosecutor. He didn't go willingly. He disputed that he was even in the video, but it was a classic operation to destroy him. And eventually, Skuratov, the prosecutor, he had to resign. And the reason we know Putin was involved was that he was actually filmed taking a copy of the video to the Russian TV station for them to play it. And then Putin even held a press conference saying that this guy Skuratov should be investigated, and it was a disgrace what he did and all the rest of it. And so the political consequence of that was very important, because the investigator Skuratov was backing a political rival of Putin. And so if you destroyed a main ally of your political rival, that helped Putin a lot. And so Yeltsin then became more pro-Putin, because Putin was investigating the guy who was investigating Yeltsin, if that makes sense.
The enemy so of my enemy.
Exactly. And so the consequence of all this is that Yeltsin then backed Putin to be his successor. And then Putin became president of Russia in late 1999, early 2000. But there's a strong case to be made that he really only became president of Russia because of a Secret Service honey trap operation against this guy Skuratov. And that's why it's so important.
It is, just as an aside, it is remarkable how often honey trap tactics are used and work. In your book, you describe, American members of Congress being asked to have a look at themselves in the mirror and to see if a 10 out of 10 really would approach them of their own volition or not, to basically check their head. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, I think even just if you take away the issue of how the KGB operated, because the CIA and Mossad, the Israeli Security Service, and I'm sure MI6, universally use honey trap operations, because let's be honest about it, the capacity of middle-aged men to be delusional about their own attractiveness to the female sex is infinite and universal, and blokes are pathetic in that sense, that they could be like a overweight, balding, 60-year-old guy sitting in the bar of a hotel in Moscow, and then they get approached by a 21-year-old, 6-foot blonde knockout who suddenly becomes interested
really
in them.
She's just really into you. She's really, like, she loves you for your mind.
Exactly, and your dynamic personality. And so a lot of men, there was a British ambassador called Geoffrey Harrison who during the Cold War, he was the British ambassador to Moscow and, very intelligent, incredibly sophisticated British establishment, public school, Oxbridge, Foreign Office. And, he was honey trapped by a housekeeper waitress. She served meals at the British embassy in Moscow. And, the ambassador was warned, they get a security briefing. When you go to Moscow and you're based at the British embassy, the same other countries the same, the staff are nearly always KGB. And they know they're all KGB, but, some of these men fall for it. And it happened a lot with gay men, which was more serious during the Cold War, because for gay men to be honey trapped was more serious because it was then a criminal offense to be gay. And so it was a very powerful weapon. And the Russians, you know, and the East German, most of the East European states during that, they actually had training centers to train female agents as honey trappers. But they also trained men who were male intelligence agents for men to honey trap women. And so it went both ways. But it was a very powerful weapon. And as a young lady yourself, you know about how pathetic men can be and how they can easily fall for these things.
I'll take that as a comment. This is Sarah Dingle in the L&L chair for Philip Adams, and I'm talking to Mark Hollingsworth about his book Agents of Influence, How the KGB Subverted Western Democracies. So let's go to the Cold War. You write about an intelligence agency spiraling out of control, accountable to no one but itself, intent on subverting Western politics on a near inconceivable scale. Tell me about the number of KGB agents in the UK and the US during the Cold War.
Well, from the, I would say, early 50s through to the early 1970s, KGB agents and spies in London and in Washington, D.C. were probably almost double what MI5 in the UK and what the FBI in the US had at their disposal in terms of spying operations, which was largely spying and trying to get into the US Congress, recruiting agents in America. They tried to recruit and influence American presidential candidates. In the UK, they tried to recruit and influence British members of parliament. And so they devoted huge resources, I mean, hundreds of millions of pounds in the 1950s and 60s, which was a lot of money, to influence, destabilize and damage NATO countries, the UK and the US. And they did it mainly by disinformation. They would forge vast numbers of documents and leak those documents just to spread chaos and confusion and damage.
Your book has an extensive list of the forged documents in its an appendix, which is an eye-opening read in its own, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, that's just a small sample, really. I mean, there wasn't enough space in the main text of the book to include all the forgeries. And their strategy was to forge vast numbers of documents, and they would fabricate, you know, even tape telephone conversations between Mrs. Thatcher and President Reagan, and they would pull together public broadcasts and speeches by Reagan and Thatcher, and then they would re-edit them and make it look as though they were having a conversation, and it was completely fake. And then they would leak that tape. But they manufactured private letters between the U.S. Defense Secretary to whatever it was, and then they would leak those documents. What their strategy was, they would fabricate like thousands of documents. They would know that 80% of the recipients, usually journalists, would understand that they were a hoax and they were a crude fake. But there was always about 10%, maybe more, of the recipients of these fake documents who would accept them as genuine, because it would fit their preconceived view of the world, of their preconceived conspiracy theory. So, for example, in Africa particularly, there were countries that were very anti the US, anti the West, pro the Soviet Union. And so if they received a document saying that CIA is going to take over your country, even if it's a fake document, it kind of told them what they wanted to hear. And so it was quite effective in that sense of destabilizing or building support for the Soviet Union in certain African countries by these fake documents. That was one of their major weapons.
Well, let's talk about from the original fake news to modern day. You say that disinformation and secret surveillance continue to play key roles in Russia's war with Ukraine. And you interviewed Valentin Nalivachenko, who was head of the Ukrainian Secret Service between 2006 and 2010 for your book. What did he tell you about the way that the FSB was operating in the region in the lead up to the invasion of Ukraine?
So Mr. Nalivachenko was head of the Ukrainian Security Service on two occasions, and he was present and head of the service in 2014 when Russia invaded Crimea and the Donetsk region. And what he discovered was that the Russian intelligence agency, the FSB, had penetrated the Ukrainian regime at that time and had bribed and recruited Ukrainians to join the FSB. And then they were able to then steal vast amounts of data within the Ukrainian government. And they were involved in disinformation, spreading fake news and, again, fake documents. But by then, 2014, it was more about obtaining disks and very confidential information within the Ukrainian government. And so it was the same policy, and I'm sure that's almost definitely happening now. I mean, the level of disinformation now in the Ukraine war is just phenomenal. And so he told me firsthand how they investigated what was going on. And it just showed that the FSB were operating in the same way in 2014 and obviously now as they did before. The only difference is the technology. So in the current situation is obviously using social media, bots, all the new technological weapons at their disposal. But the same mindset of just fabricating, just putting out conspiracy theories is the same as it was during the Cold War.
What about the GRU or the GRU, whichever one you want to call it, which is the Russian Military Intelligence Agency, which is, not to confuse everyone, but coexisted alongside the KGB and now the FSB, also active in Donetsk in 2014. What do we know about their activities?
Well, the GRU, which is the Russian Foreign Intelligence Agency, it's in a sense, it is the successor to the old KGB. It's a bit complicated because the whole thing was restructured. But the GRU mainly has been involved in more assassinations, and we've seen and getting involved in trying to murder and poison political dissidents like Navalny, or historically Litvinenko in the UK, and there's been obviously Skripal in the UK. There's been a whole series of assassinations or attempted murders against perceived enemies of Russia. And so the GRU, which is the sort of more foreign military intelligence agency, that's more their operations. And so they're basically the foreign intelligence operatives for the Russian state.
I had a bit of a light bulb moment, I suppose, when I was reading through, because it seemed that from the point of view of, KGB operatives, war, any kind of outright conflict, was simply an extension of what had already been happening. So there is always war, in other words, permanent war. Sometimes it's a conflict and sometimes it's something a bit more subtle. Do you see that as what has ultimately led to the 2014 annexation and the invasion of Ukraine? Are Putin's brutal tactics in Ukraine just following this KGB mindset?
Yes, definitely. Putin really doesn't see any difference between a war situation and peace. And he basically thinks that politics is just a perpetual struggle, a perpetual conflict. So, for example, the famous Chinese military historian Sun Tzu is a major source of influence for Russian military operations. When he argued, as an ancient Chinese philosopher and military historian, he argued that war is about deception. And it's about using deception and influence and disinformation. And that was much more important than actually having troops on the ground. And Putin believes, and his generals believe, that that the Western view that history is about periods of peace and periods of war, for Putin, life almost is a perpetual war, perpetual conflict, and that never stops. And so their influences on their thinking were people like this Chinese historian, very famous. He wrote The Art of War. And then a general from the 19th century called General von Clausewitz, who said, "War is the continuation of politics by other means." So their mindset is really that this is just another phase in the war against the West. And after Putin became president in 2000, there was a period of a relative stability until about 2007. And then he made a famous speech in Munich, which was attacking the US, which was pretty much the revival of the Cold War. And so I think the philosophical influences on Putin against the West is quite an important source of understanding the reason for this war. So like a lot of people are thinking, well, why the hell is he invading Ukraine? And I think his motivation, it's not just megalomania. I think there's a whole underlying philosophy there.
So in that case, you said Putin made that speech in 2007, which revived the Cold War. Have we been in a Cold War ever since, which has turned hot in the case of Ukraine?
Well, 2006, 2007, I can't remember the exact date, was the assassination of Alexander Litvinenko, who was a former FSB officer and moved to London, and he was a critic of Vladimir Putin and his regime. And as we all know, he was assassinated on the streets of London, poisoned in a London hotel. And the evidence shows clearly that this was done at the behest of the Russian state. And then we had the invasion of Crimea in 2014. I think it's been a series of incidents, a series of issues leading up to this. And I can't prove it, and I have no inside knowledge, but I suspect Putin has been planning and thinking about invading Ukraine for some time. But the big concern is that if he succeeds and he does annex Ukraine, is Moldova will be next, and then we're going back to the old Cold War.
Mark, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us tonight.
My pleasure.
Mark Hollingsworth is an investigative journalist and author. His new book, Agents of Influence, How the KGB Subverted Western Democracies, is published by One World.
Listen to more great stories that take you beyond the headlines. Ask your smart speaker to play ABC RN.